You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of May 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Clemency Burton-Hill and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda with the top three stories you'll need to know. We'll talk Syria, Pakistan's elections, and new developments in the Boston bombings.
American security officials will no longer be allowed direct access to their Mexican counterparts. We discuss why it could be an awkward meeting between Barack Obama and Enrique Peña Nieto.
Peña Nieto will try to argue, I think, that it's not about going back to the past. It's about reviewing security policies. It's about domestic developments and not so much the return of suspicions of bad feelings between the two countries.
What was the state of the world cities in 1913, a year before the Great War? Well, we're going to speak to the author of a new book who profiles the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Well, talking of beautiful cities, Madrid's glimmering office buildings once teemed with life, but today they're one of Spain's most visible victims of the economic crisis.
In the 50s, it was really the heart of the city, but nowadays it's not the heart, it's periphery. It's a paradox. The directional center of the city have moved to the north.
All that, plus we'll get the latest news out of Mali, review the Latin American papers, and we'll play some great music as well. That's all to come here on the next hour on Midori House.
One minute past eight this morning here in London. Looking forward to a jam-packed show, Phil. But first, let's get the news headlines from around the world with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. US authorities have charged three 19-year-old men with interfering with the investigation of the Boston Marathon bombing. The three, two students from Kazakhstan and a US citizen, were described as friends of the surviving bombing suspect Zokhar Tsarnaev. Azamat Tazayakov and Dias Karabayev were charged with conspiring to obstruct justice by disposing of a backpack containing fireworks they found in Tsarnaev's room. Third man, Robel Filipos, was charged with making false statements to investigators. Dias Karabayev's lawyer, Robert Stahl, says his client denies the charges and was appalled by the bombing.
He is just as shocked and horrified by the violence in Boston that took place as the rest of the community is. He did not know that this individual was involved in the bombing. His first inkling came much later. The government allegations, as far as that he saw a photo and recognized him immediately, we dispute, and we'll be looking forward to proving our case in court. Mr. Kadrabayev and his family are very sorry for what happened here in Boston, and he did not have anything to do with it.
The FBI has released photographs of three men who were at the scene of last September's attack in Benghazi in Libya that killed US Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans. In a statement, the FBI said it was seeking information about three individuals who were in the grounds of the US special mission when it was attacked and who may be able to provide information to help the investigation. It's not clear whether the men were involved or simply have knowledge about what happened. The photos came from surveillance video taken on the night of the attack. Suspected Muslim insurgents in southern Thailand have killed six people, including a three-year-old child. The attack took place on Wednesday night when four attackers on two motorcycles pulled up at a convenience store 500 metres from a military checkpoint in Pattani province. Police say the attackers sprayed the shop with bullets before going in to finish off their victims. They left a note saying revenge for the innocent before fleeing the scene. The attack came just 2 days after the Thai government held talks with a Muslim insurgent group in Malaysia. The Popes joined the condemnation of working conditions in Bangladesh following last week's collapse of a building in the capital Dhaka in which more than 400 factory workers were killed. Pope Francis condemned the conditions of workers who died there as slave labour. The European Union is considering trade action against Bangladesh, which has preferential access to EU markets for its garments, to pressure Dhaka to improve safety standards. Two companies which sell garments made in the collapsed building, Britain's Primark and Loblaw, parent company of the Canadian retailer Joe Fresh, have promised to compensate the families of the victims. Eric Dernbach, vice president of the International Labour Rights Forum in New York, wants American companies to follow suit.
Every American apparel company, companies like The Gap, Walmart, etc., all produce in Bangladesh. and none of them are doing anything to address the problems of unsafe factories and bad working conditions and poverty level wages in Bangladesh. They need to come forward. They need to join this effort to work on a real solution to the problems of Bangladesh. So we need more consumer pressure, and we need folks that are concerned about this issue to tell the companies that we're concerned about this.
A United Nations expert says changes in the law in India have failed to stop women falling prey to sexual violence. Following the fatal gang rape of a student, which sparked public outrage over the treatment of women in India, Rashida Manju, the UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, was sent there to investigate the rising number of cases of violent attacks on women. She says mediation and compensation measures are often used to address cases of violence, thus violating women's fundamental rights. And she concluded that women are continuing to suffer.
Despite numerous positive developments, the unfortunate reality is that the rights of many women in India continue to be violated with impunity as the norm, according to many submissions that I received.
North Korea has sentenced a 44-year-old US citizen to 15 years hard labour for committing crimes against the state. Kenneth Bai was born in South Korea but is a naturalised American citizen and attended the University of Oregon. According to US media, he's been living in Seattle. Human rights activists say he's a devout Christian and may have been arrested for taking pictures of starving children while visiting North Korea last November. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. We'll see you in about 24 minutes with another check of the world headlines. It's 6 minutes past 8 o'clock here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
This is Midori House, live from Studio One in London, where the time is 7 minutes past 8 in the morning, 7 minutes past 12 in Islamabad. Time now to get ready and set the day's agenda, choosing the three big stories that you need to know about.
And joining us today in the studio is Majid Nawaz, co-founder and executive director of Quilliam, a global think tank focusing on religious freedom, extremism and immigration, among other things. Thanks very much for coming into the studio, Majid. Let's start with Pakistan, shall we? It's just about a week and a half until elections there. But obviously the situation is still extremely unstable. Lots of bombings happening over the weekend and just on Monday as well.
Yeah, that's right. The important thing with these elections are that it's the first time in the history of the country that they are ever seeing a government complete the full term in office. Now, that's interesting considering that the country was founded in 1947. What's happened up until now is various military coups or debunking of incumbent governments have meant that the country has never seen one full term of any elected office. And that doesn't bode well for democracy. So this is an historic and unprecedented scenario for the country to go through. And it's good news for democracy on that front. And that's why I think hats off to all political parties and the incumbent government for continuing with the elections so far, fingers crossed, on schedule, despite the fact that the Taliban have launched a very fierce bombing campaign. And they've particularly decided to target members of the secular parties, the PPP, the AQM, the ANP. These parties are parties that campaign on a liberal and secular platform, the PPP being the governing party at the moment. So hats off to all of them for going ahead with these elections and not postponing them, despite this bombing campaign and despite the potential threats to their own party campaigners.
Are we likely to see an escalation in that violence between now and the election date of the 11th of May?
I'm cautious to give offer predictions, but I think yes. If we were to follow the patterns of the Pakistani Taliban's bombings of late, I think that they are likely to increase them as the election date comes forward. They're attempting probably to influence the result, to scare voters away from for voting for some of these secular parties. But Pakistan is a country that never ceases to surprise and amaze. So For example, despite the fact that we have this problem with the bombings and we have also 55 known and listed terrorists listed by Pakistan's own intelligence agencies, so it's a domestic listing, and they are still, despite that, they've put their names forward, 55 of them are running for elections. And so despite this bad news, we have cause for hope as well. So for example, two transgender, hermaphrodite candidates have put themselves forward to stand for elections to represent the underrepresented community there. And it's a country that never ceases to surprise in that way.
What are their chances, do you think? Sorry, I just have to jump in there.
Well, one of them standing in Karachi, they have, even if they don't win, one of them standing in an MQM stronghold area, but even if they don't win, the mere fact they've been approved and are running and will have that public exposure is fascinating and will grant the community itself, which is, they have quite a prominent sort of an oppressed community. It's an issue that's been going on for a long time because they are oppressed, they are underrepresented, yet they're very visible and very vocal. And it will give more visibility and more a wider platform to the transgender community in Pakistan as well. And it's interesting because you've got 55 terrorists running in the same elections as two transgender candidates. And it's just fascinating.
So in one way, Pakistanis are ready to look forward, move forward. But the front runner for the prime minister is Nawaz Sharif. He's been prime minister two times before, and it's looking like he's the likely candidate to become prime minister once again. Do you think, in a way, this is Pakistanis looking back in the future, back in the past, and not necessarily moving forward in the right direction?
It could be, or it could also be another form of poetic justice. So we know, for example, that in Egypt, the former dictator cum president is in prison, and the people that he had imprisoned are now in power. Well, the same thing with Pakistan. So Musharraf went back thinking he was General Musharraf, the former military dictator of the country, thinking he was going to contest in these elections. Actually, what's happened is he's been arrested, he's under house arrest, and he's being put on trial for treason for overthrowing the elected prime minister, who at the time was Nawaz Sharif, who had to flee the country in fear and spent many years outside the country in seeking asylum, and is now the front runner. Once again, to become prime minister while Musharraf is under house arrest. So in a sense, it's looking back, but also it's looking forward. It's saying to those who would attempt to circumvent the democratic processes in Pakistan that ultimately democracy will always win out. And so in that sense, it's also something that is it's looking forward.
Looking forward now to the Boston bombings, or looking back, but to the latest development that female DNA has been found on one of the bombs. What does this actually mean?
Yes, I think we have to be very careful. There's been some very disturbing speculation, as there always is in American right-wing media, that perhaps the wife of Tamerlan Tsarnaev could have been involved just because she's a Muslim. Now, the ordinary thing, and I know intimately terrorism cases, and generally the area of terrorism is my field. Normally, the case in such situations is that the terrorist excludes their partner, male or female, from what they're doing because it's a need-to-know basis. And it's like, well, you know, I care for you, and therefore it's best you don't know what I'm up to. Otherwise, you'll get into trouble as well. Now, he has a child with his wife, and so it's highly unlikely, in my view, that the wife was involved. And it's highly unhelpful for the US media to be using her name in this way that potentially she could be involved. What it's more likely to indicate is perhaps a seller of the materials was a female who sold them in the shops unwittingly. It could be a passers-by DNA. It could also be a female accomplice other than the wife. They're yet to find the lab where the bombs were tested and made and tried. And so I think that's another interesting area to be looking at. But I would caution against speculating about the wife's involvement.
So you do mention there that it was likely that his wife was indeed left out of his plans. But even yesterday, U.S. authorities charged three men with interfering with the investigation, trying to cover up elements of finding a backpack with, a used firework. What do we know of these three gentlemen and how they could be connected? Do you think it's something more serious than, what we're thinking? Or is it just that they were a bit uncomfortable with the idea of being friends with this guy?
I think the likely scenario is that the major leads that we would have had in this story, which would probably point us to some form of international connection, died along with the older brother. And the younger brother was probably radicalized by his older brother. So his connection to any form of organized network died along with the older brother. So what we'll probably find now are amateurs who, at the last moment, help their friends or something like this. And I think what's more important is for the FBI to follow the leads in Dagestan, looking at the moment. Some of their agents are there. Again, The problem is that the Russian reaction, as could have been predicted, has been unhelpful. The Russians have launched a very fierce and violent crackdown and have decided to shoot everyone and kill many people that would have provided some intelligence value to this case. And let's also, for your listeners, put something forward there and say that there is a legitimate Chechen struggle for independence against Russia. I say legitimate in the sense that it deserves a hearing, not to take sides one way or the other, but it does deserve a hearing. And of course, let's not allow the Russians to paint every single Chechen as a terrorist just because they want independence for their country.
Talking about independence for a country, let's talk about Syria and this story that's been on the rise recently about the European fighters, and including 100 Brits, who've joined the jihadist cause. And tell us more about your take on that.
Well, it's very worrying. The head of, European counterterrorism coordinator, Gilles Dekakov, basically said that there are roughly 500 European-born Muslims who've gone to Syria to join the jihadist groups. Then the man in the UK, the head of the Office for Security and Counterterrorism here, Charles Farr, said that up to 100 British men have gone. Now, what we already know is that British born and London-accented Muslims have shot at and have actually wounded a British journalist in Syria. So we know that there are already Brits there who are trying to attack and kill their fellow citizens. We know that because it hit the press when this journalist came back and gave interviews. He came to my own office. I spoke to him. And he was, he was telling us about their South London accents. These are young jihadists who are shooting at him with Kalashnikovs in South London accents. So we know that's there. Now, what I'm really worried about is this another Afghanistan? And this is something I've been speaking about on the media recently, which is what happens to these up to 100 Brits when they return to the UK, and up to 500 European fighters when they go back to their various countries, the Netherlands, France and others? What do they do? These are battle-hardened, ideologically dogmatic jihadist fighters. Now, some people would say, well, what's Syria got to do with us? We're supporting the uprising. Well, what's America got to do with Chechnya and the Russian sort of war there? So jihadism is unpredictable in that way.
But you're saying that they will be that their ideological position will be intensified by the experience of fighting, because presumably they're already driven by those impulses. Otherwise, they wouldn't have gone to fight in the first place.
Indeed. And it's very likely that they may decide to set their sights on Europe, only because that ideology doesn't differentiate between who's been supporting the Syrian uprising and who hasn't. It divides the world along Muslim and non-Muslim lines, which is what we saw with Boston. You would expect Chechens to attack Russians, but they didn't. They attacked Americans. And so I'm very worried about what happens to these fighters when they get back to the UK. And it's a ticking time bomb. And we really need to start looking at this a lot more carefully.
And briefly, just staying in Syria, 2 years on, 70,000 people dead. There's a growing influence from Al-Qaeda in that country. Is there a fear that the rebels are starting to become radicalized and could potentially, once this conflict finds some sort of conclusion, turn on the Americans because essentially they were fed up with what they didn't do?
Yes, so it's in Syria. The most effective military group at the moment, the militant group at the moment, is Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the Al-Qaeda affiliate there. They aren't the most popular, but they are by far the most effective. And there is a huge danger that they will end up hijacking the uprising. Now, it's in everyone's interests in Syria that doesn't happen, but it's in the dictatorship's interests that does happen. And that's why it's almost funny in a way that Bashar al-Assad is encouraging that, because he wants to paint the whole uprising in that light. So they will probably be having support from the dictator as well, which is really strange, but that's what's going on.
Fascinating stuff. Majid Nawaz, co-founder and executive director of Quilliam, many thanks for indeed coming
Pleasure.
On the show.
Coming up, Obama is in Mexico, hot on the heels of our very own Steve Bloomfield, I might add, to meet the man of the moment who's south of the border. We'll have the latest.
Grass is legendary when it comes to the alchemy of perfume making. Monocle's film crew travel to the south of France to discover a new generation inheriting these traditions and making them their own.
My first souvenirs, we were working with flowers with my sister, trying to create and invent and of course sell some perfumes from our own. So yes, it was in our DNA. But perfume is a wonderful world, and we're very lucky to have that in the family.
Making Sense, in the film's menu on Monocle.com.
You You're back with Midori House, 19 minutes past 8 here in London. Today, the President of the United States, Barack Obama, meets the President of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto. One in his second term, the other just 150 days into his six-year stint. Both men will seek to affirm the domestic issues that will reform the bilateral agenda between those two particular neighbours.
Immigration reform on the US side, stronger economic ties that boost jobs for America and exports for Mexico, and improve security along the borderlands whose reputation is continually being undermined by the trafficking of drugs. All hot topics which will be under discussion. Well, I caught up with Antonio Sampao of the International Institute of Strategic Studies to find out what was on the agenda. A big visit tomorrow by President Obama to Mexico. Lots on the agenda, the economy. But one of the big issues, of course, is security. What can you tell us that is expected to be discussed at this meeting?
I think Obama will ask for more clarification on how the Mexican government plans exactly to review the security cooperation. During the Calderón administration, the previous president, security cooperation has had a huge boost. The law enforcement agencies in both sides of the border have been cooperating quite closely and directly. And now the Mexican government has indicated that it's going to be this direct relation will diminish a little bit and will be centralized in the Interior Ministry. They are creating this super powerful Interior Ministry and replacing the Public Security Secretariat. Now, the Interior Ministry will centralize intelligence, will centralize the various police agencies in Mexico, and that is a kind of domestic development. They are trying to better coordinate and better communicate with the various security agencies. So the decision to centralize U.S. relations with security agencies in Mexico on that ministry has a kind of domestic element to it. But there is also an attempt to refocus the cooperation and refocus kind of the narrative about Mexico, trying to focus on Mexico as the economic powerhouse that Mexico actually is. The media in the US and the media outside and these bilateral policies have been too focused on security. That's what the Mexican government thinks. And they have been trying to make the Merida initiative, the aid that the US provides for Mexican security initiatives, to be more focused on social issues, development, youth programs, job creation. That has been increasing in the past few years. And I think Peña Nieto, during this meeting, will try to increase the focus on that and try to press the US government to focus more on those kinds of things.
Well, let's discuss those bilateral security relationships. This was big news last week when President Peña Nieto announced that American law enforcement officials will no longer have direct access. So they will now need to go to the Interior Ministry, as you discussed, the mass centralization of power. What's the move then behind this centralization of power, and why has the Mexican position changed so dramatically?
It remains to be seen how much of that will actually happen in practice, how much will actually change. What will probably change immediately will be the direct dialogue that law enforcement agents have with the counterparts in both sides of the border. I think that will be particularly felt in intelligence sharing. Now intelligence will go to a new centralized intelligence service that has also been recently created, and that is an attempt to better coordinate, better communicate between the different agencies. This attempt is part of a domestic drive to improve security coordination, also of this public relations drive.
And some American officials are already expressing some concern. There's this concern that perhaps the relationship with Mexico could return to that before the 2000 election when the Institutional Revolutionary Party was in power. Obviously, relations back then wasn't necessarily as good as it was during Calderón. Is that a concern that President Peña Nieto will try to alleviate?
Yes. Before the PRI left power, the Institutional Revolutionary Party has governed Mexico for 7 decades during the 20th century, and there was a lot of suspicion, a lot of bad feelings towards the U.S. because of the history of wars and tarnished relations. That has dramatically improved during the government of Felipe Calderón, especially. Recently, these announcements of a review of the security policies have kind of created this feeling that things might go back to the past. But Peña Nieto will try to argue, I think, that it's not about going back to the past. It's about reviewing security policies. It's about domestic developments and not so much the return of suspicions of bad feelings between the two countries.
And let's discuss one of perhaps the most central parts of that security discussion, which I'm sure will focus on the drug war in Mexico. It's a big problem in Mexico, still is. It's also a problem in many border towns along the Mexico-America border. There are fences along parts of that border, but of course it's not 100%. What's being done to really combat that fear from the Americans?
The drug war continues, even though the current government is trying not to talk about a drug war. So they're trying to focus the security policies into development, social issues, and display less of the drug kingpins that are arrested and make big spectacular shows of force. This will continue. I think that tends to be the way that the security policies will work now. The homicide rates have been falling, although we don't know precisely why. It has fallen 14% between December and April of this year from the same period 1 year ago. This is probably not related to the announcement by Peña Nieto that he plans to focus more on curbing violence that directly affects his citizens and less on targeting the drug lords. So we don't know how much of that new policy, that new strategy is behind this reduction in violence. The most important thing is that the brutal massacres continue and the organized crime groups retain their power to directly challenge the government in many areas of the country.
And finally, Antonio, what do we know about Obama and Peña Nieto's relationship and how important will that be going forward in the next few years?
We will see how much of the U.S. policies that Mexico wants the U.S. to implement will actually happen. The Obama government has been pushing for arms control measures in the U.S. that have been blocked in Congress. That has not been well received in Mexico, but at least there is the feeling that Obama is doing something.
And that was Antonio Sampao of IISS talking to me there a little earlier about the upcoming visit today between Barack Obama and President Peña Nieto. You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Clemency Burton-Hill. This week, The Urbanist is investigating the empty spaces in our cities, from an abandoned airport in Santiago to a haunted house in Hong Kong. Well, in this preview, we're looking at Madrid's empty office space. While the city's plazas are perpetually packed with people, many of the buildings that line them have been left empty, a symptom of a transforming city center and a struggling economy.
Madrid's Plaza de España is perhaps the most conspicuous sign of this change. In more affluent times, it symbolized the rise of the Spanish capital, home to Europe's tallest buildings and considered as the greatest of Madrid's countless public squares. But as the city's fortunes changed, so did those of the plaza. Our correspondent, Leon Aldous, joined local urbanist and city architect José María Ezquiaga at the plaza's central fountain to take in the view of the abandoned buildings surrounding it.
This is probably one of the heart of the hearts of Madrid. The other may be Puerta del Sol. You must consider in the beginning of the 20th century, the main project in Madrid was to the opening of a new street, a new big street called Gran Vía, big street, great street, with the new buildings, was thought to be the new reference overall for the new capitalism in this moment, starting in Spain, the new banks. In the 20s of the last century. In that moment was redesigned both the last trail of the Gran Vía and also the last trail of Princesa. And the meeting point of both streets is here, is Plaza de España.
So what do you think happened then to the plaza? Why did it go into disrepair?
In the 50s, it was really the heart of the city. But nowadays, it's not the heart. It's periphery. It's a paradox because it looks like to be a central area. You have the Gran Vía. You have all in the same places. But what happened? The directional center of the city have moved to the north. And nowadays, maybe around Plaza Castilla, just 5 kilometers from here. This is the reason of the decay and the obsolete of the Gran Vía, also of the recent evolution around this square.
Yet it's not just the square that has fallen into disrepair, which, might I add, is far from empty on this sunny day, but also the grand buildings which border three of its sides. The big guy on the block is Edificio España. Built by a dictator, it was once the tallest building in Spain and was a giant office building until it was abandoned many years ago. It was later sold for 389 million euros to a property developer who aimed to convert the mammoth structure into luxury apartments. But this was before the economic crisis hit Spain, and years later the project has been put on hold, its street-level windows boarded up, and no one knows if or when it will begin to show signs of life once again. It's the perfect metaphor for the country's economic woes.
Why is this building empty now? Why is it suddenly this empty shell in the middle of the city?
It's a problem of urban ecology. The new area for offices is in the north of the city. And here in the city center, we have in a nobody land because it's the heart of the image of the city, but it's not appreciated by the companies. Only if in the case of renew the old quarter, maybe a new pole, a new hub in competition with the north of Madrid. If the best places in the new area for offices, the new CBD of Madrid, are empty, it has sense that here in an area in crisis, in an area in transition from one era to new era, you have the same problem.
That's an interesting point, actually. The new grand four skyscrapers that Madrid built are only half filled. So do you think they should just stop building and maybe focus on the great buildings they have? Would make sense, wouldn't it?
No, maybe, but this is the result of the crisis. The standard of necessity of a square meter for offices is always growing. In all the cities like Madrid, Paris, London, it's always the same.
Turning to our right, on the plaza's eastern side, three adjoining multi-story buildings are another stark reminder of economic decline. Covered in graffiti, with many of its shattered glass panels looking eerily like empty eye sockets, these buildings aren't completely empty, as they are home to some squatters who have some of the best views in the city.
It's said that these buildings may be in the next future, a big new hotel.
So there is movement, there is change on the horizon in the plaza.
Because are well located, have a great dimension, it's not so easy to find in Madrid lots of this size.
If you actually go to a couple of buildings down, we've got the old headquarters for Minas de Asturias, which is the old Asturian mine headquarters, which is also very symbolic of the crisis. It's a symbol of the old economy, which doesn't exist, and the building's empty.
The Cayenne and the, so it's a symbol of the decline of the square as a symbolic place, an iconic place of the city. No.
So what can be done? Should the city council do more to attract investment, or even tenants, to restore these empty vessels to their former glory? Or should they go down the punitive path? Authorities in Barcelona recently proposed a new tax on empty housing, and I ask José María whether Madrid should follow suit.
Overall, in housing, this strategy is effective. It's effective, and we have the experience of many other countries with that. From the government of the city, they must follow both strategies. The first, the easier one, is a sort of taxation to make inconvenient to keep your buildings empty, of course. But another way may be promote, offer outside with the companies, with the owners of the buildings, the space, and to have some project for the whole area able to be presented with the offer of these empty buildings in the real estate market in the international real estate market. No? For me, one of the faces of the crisis is evident, is the rate of unemployment, decreasing of investment, like in this area, but the other face of decreasing is the depression of the people and the depression of the people in the government of the city and the government of the nation. No? We need people who believe in their city, able to believe in their country, and with ideas for the day after the crisis.
And you can hear the full episode of The Urbanist, a brand new episode premiering tonight at 1900 hours London time.
And in the next half hour of the programme, we'll be discussing the new book by author Charles Emerson, The World Before the Great War. We'll take a tour of the Brazilian front pages and get the latest from our correspondent in Mali. But before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. US authorities have charged three 19-year-old men with interfering with the investigation of the Boston Marathon bombing. The three, two students from Kazakhstan and a US citizen, were described as friends of the surviving suspect, Zokhar Tsarnaev. The FBI has released photographs of three men who were at the scene of last September's attack in Benghazi in Libya, which killed US Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans. The photos came from surveillance video taken on the night of the attack. Suspected Muslim insurgents in southern Thailand have killed six people, including a three-year-old child. Police said four attackers sprayed a convenience store with bullets before going in to finish off their victims. They left a note saying, "Revenge for the innocent." The Pope has joined the condemnation of working conditions in Bangladesh following last week's collapse of a building in the capital Dhaka in which more than 400 factory workers were killed. Pope Francis condemned the conditions of workers who died there as slave labour. The United Nations expert says changes in the law in India have failed to stop women falling prey to sexual violence. Rashida Manju, the UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, says mediation and compensation measures are often used to address cases of attacks on women, thus violating their fundamental rights. North Korea has sentenced a 44-year-old US citizen to 15 years hard labour for committing crimes against the state. Human rights activists say Kenneth Bai is a devout Christian and may have been arrested for taking pictures of starving children while visiting North Korea in November. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
This is Midori House. It's 36 minutes past 8 here in London. Optimistic, modern and internationalist. Not necessarily a description one would associate with life before the Great War, but that's the position put forward by our next guest in his epic survey of 20 global cities during the year 1913.
Far from the clichés of the turn of the century era, a new book called 1913, The World Before the Great War, alleges it was a time that cannot be reduced to the Downton-esque frivolity of the aristocratic community or the turn-of-the-century pessimism of popular history. Charles Emerson, author of The World Before the Great War, now joins us in the studio. Thanks very much for coming into the studio, Charles. A fascinating book. I had a chance to have a read through it yesterday. It is, as Clemency said, quite an epic read. Lots of cities in there. Tell us a bit about why you decided to write this book.
Well, look, I think the first thing is next year, 2014, we're going to have the centenary of the start of the Great War, and there's going to be a lot of commemoration around that. But I've always been fascinated about how the world looked before, and that's a period of history that we tend to view in sepia tone. We tend to view it in black and white, and I wanted to sort of bring back the colour, the sense of possibility, the sense of optimism. This is a time before the war that we tend to view now as where war was sort of predestined. This is a doomed generation. There's something very tragic about that vision of the time. But actually, how did things look then? And of course, inevitably, people had other concerns, people had hopes and aspirations for the future, and there was pretty good reason for believing actually that war, A, might not happen. If it did happen, it wouldn't be the war which did happen, and that globalization, integration, technological development would continue as it had over the previous 20, 30, 40, 50 years, century.
Charles, it's clearly a vast body of work. It's a very hefty tome, but it's an ingenious way of thinking about the world at that point as well. How did you come up with the idea of saying, right, I will take a sort of survey, panoramic survey of the globe, and I will take these 20 key cities and look at it through their eyes, as it were?
Well, I think the cities are absolutely key to the book, and they sort of anchor it. They give it they give you a sense of place, which I think is very, very important.
Give us a taste, first of all, sort of what the cities are, of the obvious ones.
Well, I've got the European cities, which are sort of unavoidable: London, Paris, Berlin, Vienna, St. Petersburg, etc. But I also wanted to include places that were perhaps more off the mental beaten track, if you like. So places such as Winnipeg, You know, Buenos Aires, which was very much a city of the future at that time, Shanghai, Tokyo, Algiers, Durban, Bombay. So give a truly global perspective, because that's another thing about the way that we tend to view that period, at least certainly in Britain, I think in Europe, we tend to focus very much on Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And we forget that this was a truly globalized world. We forget that global, the global horizons of people at that time. And so I wanted to bring that back by looking at these other cities.
I thought it was fascinating that, you know, at this time when there were such deep national rivalries between the differing countries, that even back then in 1913, you were arguing that Europe was trying to look at itself as a national, as a, you know, a continental identity in a way, much like how Europe is trying to do itself today.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's one of these funny things about this period that if you look at, for example, where various politicians and generals were actually just before the outbreak of war in 1914, you know, a huge number of them were abroad in places such as Monte Carlo or Karlovy Vary or Baden-Baden, sort of these spa towns, which were the places where aristocrats and now the bourgeoisie went on their long extended holidays. If you go to places like Venice and you look at the hotels of the Lido, you know, they're all from that time.
Mm-hmm.
This is a period of history where people were able to travel much, much more freely. You could travel around Europe without a passport. You know, one of the sources I use for the book quite a lot is sort of Baedeker guides, which are fascinating for the insight they provide of an idea of, you know, Europe opening up, the world opening up.
Absolutely.
So this coexists with stronger national identity.
Apart from that, apart from sort of revealing that the world was very different to how we might perceive it, what was the biggest revelation for you? Because it's, as I say, a huge amount of research, obviously. Was there a sort of standout moment where something was really illuminated for you that you hadn't been expected?
Well, I think that for me, looking at China was very, very important. I hadn't quite realised the extent to which around the time of 1913, China had gone through tremendous economic transformations, but also tremendous political transformations. You get the end of the Qing dynasty, the end of empire, the beginning of a Chinese republic. And the idea that maybe in 1913, you know, maybe China is going to edge its way towards a parliamentary republican democracy until the leader of the party that wins the elections of late 1912, early 1913 is assassinated in Shanghai, Song Jiaren. And this figure, who seems completely lost to our understanding of China, you know, is a truly key figure. He could have been the first prime minister of a republican democratic China. Imagine how different the world would have been.
Mind-boggling.
Well, and you know, everyone remembers the assassination in Sarajevo in 1914. But perhaps actually for world history, this was maybe equally important.
And it was fascinating as well, Charles. You broke down the contents of the book into different categories. So you had center of the universe, the old new world, the world beyond. How much of these categories do you still think, I guess hindsight is a great thing, today, looking at these categories and whether these cities, you know, are they drastically different to how they were? Are they similar?
Well, I mean, obviously there are some cities on that list in 1913 which wouldn't appear on the list now. I mean, an example of that is Winnipeg. You know, I mean, if you go to Winnipeg now, it's rather like sort of the place that time forgot. It's as if, you know, the clock stopped on the 31st of December 1913. Tremendously grand buildings from that era, but you know, it's not a tremendously prepossessing place now. So, you know, I think the list would be different today. I mean, you'd have other global cities. You'd have, you know, you'd have Dubai, you'd have Singapore. But I think one of the interesting things about that is to remember there were global cities in 1913 that, when globalization turned back, those cities, you know, were no longer the cities of the future. And I think one can also point to Dubai and various other places and say, well, you know, they are so dependent on a certain way of the world working, and that may not last forever.
It's a great thing that 100 years on, you can write a book that really opens everything up and sheds new light on a period that I think people do think we understand. And especially in the age, as Phil mentioned in his cue, you know, the sort of Downton Abbey era, we're sort of full of those pictures of that sort of Edwardian time and thinking that we understand it. But actually, clearly we don't. How instructive and useful is it to be able to say, have a rethink?
Well, I mean, I think it's actually very, very important for foreign policymakers today. I mean, I was talking with somebody the other day about Sarajevo moments. The idea that, you know, something could go wrong, for example, in the East China Sea or in Syria or in Iran, and this could lead to a series of events, miscalculations, which lead to something that no one really expects, certainly no one really wants. And I think as we move into an era of really great geopolitical uncertainty, it's important to remember that the world will not necessarily continue along its present path of globalization and integration. You know, this is, we sort of have to will the future that we want to live in.
And shock horror, we learn nothing from history yet again. Charles, thank you so much for joining us. It's a fascinating book. It's 1913. It's out now, The World Before the Great War. Thank you so much for joining us here on Midori House.
Great pleasure.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back after this to explore the stories in Mali today, military trainings, an attempted coup in neighboring Chad, and freedom of the press. Don't go away.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
You can be European, meaning reliable, responsible, you believe in democracy and environmental protection and, you know, equal justice. These are all Islamic values too.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
It's not like New York, because New York, it's like you can walk to Central Park, you can walk anywhere you want. There's an urban continuity. In here, you have to get into a car or get into something that moves and get out of here.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets, and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists, and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Here's a little bit of a song by Gilberto Gil. Getting us in the mood for our Latin American press review, which is just about to come up. That was, of course, Gilberto Gil with Aquel Abraço, the former Brazilian culture minister. I think we have a future Brazilian culture minister potentially sitting here in the studio. Fernando
<wish.
laughs> Augusto Pacheco, our resident Brazilian expert. I think he's one of your favourite artists, is that
right?
Oh,
I love it. It's such an emotional song. It's a classic.
What
it's
is he
classic.
Singing about?
It's all about happiness. This song's actually, it's kind of a tribute to Rio de Janeiro.
Ooh.
And just the translation of Aquele Abraço is that hug.
How lovely.
It's lovely and warm. It's great for a lovely sunny
morning.
You're
looking very warm today in your beautiful ensemble. Nice pair of shorts, a beautiful polo shirt. I feel like I could be on the beach in Ipanema or something.
You do realise that we're in central London and it's really cold outside.
It's nice to pretend you're someone else sometimes.
You brought a couple of the Brazilian front pages for us. Fernando, shall we start with the O Globo newspaper?
Let's start with O Globo. This is something that's been going on, and actually, the Globo, they're doing like a campaign. Do you remember when the British newspaper The Times, when they did a campaign about cyclist deaths in London? They're doing something similar, and basically this is happening because a cyclist called Pedro Nicolai, he was a triathlete actually, and he was hit by a bus 2 days ago in Rio, and this has been an ongoing problem. There's been many accidents and deaths in Rio de Janeiro. He was on the cycle lane, so basically it was not his fault, and then basically there's been a huge problem in Rio. Buses, they're not respecting the traffic, basically. And then you can see on the picture here on Ipanema Beach, a lot of cyclists wearing black, and they were protesting on that. And then it's interesting. Can you see the picture below? Mm. It's on the same day that he died, you can see another bus like going through a red A red light, exactly. So it's but now Mayor Eduardo Paes, he announced that all the drivers will be identified and punished because
drivers who've gone through red lights or who've not neglected traffic regulations.
Exactly, okay. Exactly.
Not just every driver.
Oh no. But all of the drivers, 18,000 of them, they will go for another driving license test.
Wow. Because I think sorry, Fernando, to butt in. So 18,000. Drivers, bus drivers, have already been known to be in breach of those regulations.
No, actually, all of them will have to do.
Even the ones who comply.
Exactly, just wow. To kind of...
like a refresher course.
Exactly,
almost,
exactly.
And is this as a result of the protests? Or yeah. Wow, that's extraordinary. You know, this has happened so fast.
One of those deaths that caused like so much commotion that yeah. People kind of do something. They even changed the law because of that. But
it's
I hope
encouraging that the politicians have actually listened and are doing something... It's about time. About it.
About time, because the traffic in Rio can be a little bit chaotic sometimes, in my opinion.
No, really? well, politics in Brazil, that chaotic? Tell us more about what Dilma Rousseff has been saying recently.
Well, yesterday was a big holiday in Brazil. Well, in many countries of the world, it's International Labour Day. But, you know, it's the political campaign for the presidential elections next year is started. And Dilma, basically, she did a speech kind of defending, saying that her government's doing everything she can to control the inflation, which is a big worry for Brazilians at the moment. And of course, the leader of the opposition, Aécio Neves, he said that actually the government's not doing enough. And actually, he said that that's quite risky because one of the best things about Brazil in the last years, in my opinion as well, is that we kind of managed to control our inflation. Because in the 90s, especially in the early 90s, it was terrible. I mean, I don't know exactly the number, but it was about like 1,000%, you know. Mm. It was really a huge economic crisis. And in the last year, since Fernando Henrique Cardoso, our president in 94, and Lula in 2002, I mean, we managed to control. I don't think the situation is that bad, but we do have to control because it's been rising.
So and what are the prospects of Dilma looking like for the election?
She's the favorite to win, and but you know you should never assume because in Brazil we have you know we show the political campaign on TV 3 months before, and that changes everything. TV is still one of the most important media, and this guy Aécio Neves, he's a very charming and charismatic guy. The only problem is he's a bit of a playboy, you know, so I worry that I'm sure there'll be a lot of scandals maybe. And I don't know what are his chances.
You mentioned Lula there. There is a possibility that he might pop up again in the 2018 elections. That presumably would be met with mixed reviews.
Exactly. You know, some people say, oh, he wants too much power or whatever. Actually, a lot of people thought Lula would want a third mandate in 2010, but he didn't. He didn't want to be like a Brazilian Hugo Chavez. So he said, no, let's go for a different candidate.
But Dilma was very much his candidate.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she was elected because of him. When she won, she actually proved that she's slightly different. Mm-hmm. She's kind of more she's not as charismatic as Lula, but she's doing quite a good job. I think Brazilians like her in general. But the mayor of São Paulo, Fernando Haddad, said that there might be a chance that Lula come back in 2018. I'm not sure, but well, it's over there.
Wait and see.
Wait and see.
But something that we do know is the world's best 50 restaurants. And I understand that you've actually had the pleasure of going to two of those restaurants.
I did. They're both in my hometown, São Paulo. And I'm really happy to see Brazilian restaurants in those lists. We have number 6 was Dom by Alex Atala. And it's a great restaurant, Dom. I mean, it was probably one of the best meals I ever had. And then the number 46 is Mani. It's in São Paulo as well, which is lovely. And it's funny, they have two very different atmospheres. Like if you want to go on a date, I would recommend Mani because you can even put your feet on the... It's like outside and it's very relaxed and it's kind of... How can I say this? Brazilian food from the Amazon, it's lovely.
Does this represent a real resurgence in Brazilian cuisine? And are we likely to see more Latin American and indeed Brazilian hotspots, culinary, gastronomic hotspots coming up?
Absolutely. I think we're proud of our cuisine now because if 10, 20 years ago, the best thing was to go to a French restaurant in São Paulo. But now if you want to go to the best, you go to a Brazilian restaurant in São Paulo, not a French one or Italian or...
I suggest we just hop on a plane, Phil. Go on a date to
well,
Manny.
He's telling us the place to go for a date, Manny.
Have a beetroot risotto. It's very special.
Wow.
It's very special.
Fernando, I think we're going to have to leave it there very sadly. It's always lovely to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for joining us, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. That's sadly all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thank you very much to our excellent producer, Alid John, our researcher, Fernando himself, and Annabelle Bly, and also our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Up next after the news, Rob Bound will be hosting this week's edition of Culture Show. That's not to be missed.
Bye-bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.